Commodity prices fluctuate, landscaping trends come and go, but the land remains. And the decisions we make today about how we treat the land have serious long-term consequences. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Aldo Leopold once wrote, "We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect." Today, we're going to talk about our relationship with that community, the people, the plants, the animals, and the land. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When settlers came to Iowa, most of them were looking for land they could farm, and they found it, the most fertile land in the world. When Iowa became an agricultural state, the prairie was plowed under, and very little wilderness remained. Today, we're going to talk about the land of Iowa, public land, private land, and how the decisions we make today will impact generations to come. With me is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Hello, Jim.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And in Iowa, we have kind of a unique situation because Iowa was settled by people who wanted to farm the land. And so much of our state is farmable. We don't have mountains. We didn't have giant forests. So very little wilderness was left in Iowa.
Well, it's certainly not wilderness in the sense that we think of it today. I guess some of the early settlers, if you read Giants in the Earth and some of those early novels, there would be those who would say the prairie was indeed a wilderness. We were predominantly a prairie state, and boy, if you read some of those early accounts of the winds constantly blowing and nothing on the horizon but prairie, it was a pretty wilderness environment to them. It certainly wasn't the kind of wilderness that we currently have in the West or in Alaska and with lots of trees and that sort of thing. But it certainly was a very, very rich land. Jim Dinsmore, in his book, A Country So Full of Game, reminds us of how rich it was, filled with wild species that impressed all of the earlier, Euro-American explorers, Lewis and Clark, et cetera, et cetera. They came and they saw critters everywhere, 60 million bison, not just in Iowa, but across the plains, elk and deer, lots and lots of predators on those as well, and birds galore. So it was really an incredibly rich environment, and we certainly changed that. It still is a very rich environment, and some would argue, in fact, that our soils are certainly the richest in the world, and I think there's no argument with that. But it came from the prairie, and so the prairie is sort of the basis of that richness.
In Iowa, during the summer months when so many of us are going to our wonderful state parks, it's probably easy to forget this, but Iowa does not have much public land.
No, that's for sure. In fact, Iowa is very much a private land state. We have, if you count all of the county, state, and the few pieces of federal ownership we have in the state, we have less than 2% of our land in public ownership. That means 2%. You say, well, that's quite a lot. You know, well, it sort of is, except that when you compare it across the nation, we are next to last in the country in the terms of the percent of our land in public ownership. And when I hear people complain about, oh, that government land, you know, it really is a false a sense of what's here. 2% is next to last. The only state that has less public land than Iowa, a lower proportion of public land than Iowa, is Rhode Island. And so we are next to last. It dismayed me when, in the last legislative session, and I think lots and lots of other people, if they thought about it, that even with being next to last in the nation, there were some legislators in the state house who wanted to sell some of that, put it into crop production or whatever. I was just absolutely shocked that they would even consider something like that when we already have so little land in public ownership.
Well, the theory that I was introducing a few minutes ago is that because so much of our land was farmable and we don't have these major landmarks or land formations that so many other places have,
right,
that it was easy to not set aside any public land, because a lot of the public land in our country comes from places that could not be farmed.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And it's not a... it's not a landscape that is dramatic. I've always argued with my my brother and sister in Wisconsin that Iowans, we appreciate the small places, because that's what we have, the little places. You know, we don't have huge expanses of huge, monstrous public parks. I stopped in my wife and I camp a lot, and we stopped in a state park in upstate New York, right on the border between New York and Pennsylvania, we could put all of our state parks inside that one state park, and there'd still be land left over. I think it was 63,000 acres in one state park in upstate New York. We don't have that in Iowa. Most of our state parks are pretty small. So you're right. I think that because it's been such productive land agriculturally, we haven't chosen to set aside large areas. In fact, if you look at sort of the history of state parks, many of them had, you know, the potential to be much larger than they were, but the legislature and the people at the time said, no, let's keep it within X number of acres rather than Y. And that means that many of our state parks were smaller than they originally started out to be.
So the agriculture in the state clearly set, and our lack of giant land formations,
right,
set this trend in motion. But it sounds like you're saying that there's also a culture in Iowa.
Yeah, I think there is. And that's why I say, I started out by saying that Iowa is a private land state, and we certainly are. And there's nothing wrong with that, as long as we realize, we as landowners, and that includes all of us, urban and rural, that we share this land with other critters. Some would say, including E.O. Wilson, a famous ecologist from Harvard, and many, many others, would say that we are intimately linked with those other critters, that, in fact, we ignore that fact at our peril, that they are sort of the canaries in the coal mines, if you will, that if as they go, so go we eventually. And what I worry about, and the reason I wanted to have this conversation on conservation today, is that I see us losing that contact at the very time which we can most afford to make sure that we have wildland set aside. We seem to be going in the opposite direction faster than ever.
On this program, we have talked about many different species in Iowa that seem to be making a tremendous comeback, because mm-hmm. there was a time when the land was settled, when it was being farmed, and many of these species disappeared because they were hunted,
right,
out of existence,
right,
in the state of Iowa. As they've been making a comeback, is that an indication that we have been doing a better job creating habitat?
Yeah, I think up to a certain point that's very true. And we've done it sort of in fits and starts. If you look, for example, you could look at populations of almost any grassland bird over the last half century, and see them in Iowa, particularly the populations of them, come and go as various farm programs come and go. Most recently, we've had over the last, since about 1985, we've had farm bills that had very strong conservation titles. And when you have more than 80% of the land in any landscape associated with one particular industry, in this case agriculture, there's a very dominant effect of that industry on the land. And as well, in our history, you could argue that the Farm Bill is the single most important piece of legislation that impacts wildlife in the Midwest. So if you look from 1985 forward, there have been very strong conservation titles, and there has been conservation compliance, meaning that if you are going to receive certain benefits from the Farm Bill, you have to comply with the regulations, the express desire of society to make sure that that land is well cared for. An example would be the Conservation Reserve Program. Conservation Reserve Program has put lots of grassland back on the land, replaced what at one time or another were row crops, and those grasslands, that prairie land, brought back a lot of bird species, a lot of things that were quickly disappearing from the nation came back. They responded. You put habitat there, and by golly, they respond. It's pretty amazing. Things like meadowlarks and bobolinks, things that I think a lot of our ancestors or relatives took for granted. Of course they're going to be here. Well, as that grassland disappeared and disappeared and disappeared, the birds went with it. And so many indeed have responded to those programs. But I say it is fits and starts. I think we've done a very, very good job of learning how to conserve soil. And now we need to apply that even more, my belief is, to wildlife. If we're going to have wildlife down the road, we have to depend on private landowners to do the right thing when it comes to wildlife. And I think increasingly we're not.
When we talk about the Conservation Reserve Program, I think in spite of the fact that it clearly impacts the populations of wild creatures, most of us think about that program not because of the health of wild creatures, but because of the health of farmers.
Sure.
And that was the whole goal, to ensure financial security for farmers.
Well, it wasn't. It depends who you talk to. If you talk to the conservation community, who supported, beginning in 1985, very strong conservation provisions, everything from sod buster to swamp buster provisions, the conservation compliance provisions. That indeed was their goal. But I think USDA's goal was commodity control so that we could keep prices up. You're absolutely right.
Well, we'll continue this conversation in just a moment. I'm talking with wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and today we're talking about the land in Iowa, public land, private land, our responsibility and relationship with that land. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. And today we're talking about our relationship with the land in Iowa. We're a state with very little public land. So what we choose to do with our private land affects the entire ecosystem of the state of Iowa. And that's what we're talking about right now. Before the break, we were talking about the Conservation Reserve Program, how it was introduced in 1985, and how that has dramatically impacted wild creatures in the state of Iowa. And Jim, I was playing a little bit of a devil's advocate there. Clearly, the Conservation Reserve Program had two goals when it was founded, but it did come out of the farm crisis.
It certainly did.
And it was intended in many ways to secure the financial health and survival of farmers. Mm-hmm. As time has gone on, have you seen changes in intention and how that program has been carried out?
Well, certainly, as contracts expired, many landowners, as particularly corn and bean prices rose, many landowners decided to get out of it and put it back into row crop production, albeit with better conservation, soil conservation on the land. But the birds that nested there, the other species of wildlife, the mammals, the reptiles, the amphibians, the birds, they had no choice. They were gone. And whenever you, I think at one point we had in Iowa 2.2 million acres in CRP. I think we're down, maybe our callers can remind me what the figure is now, but I think we're down to around 1.4 million, 1.5 million. Now, I'm not saying that people haven't responded. They do. The 43rd sign-up for CRP, this is when farmers say, yes, I'd like to put X number of acres in CRP. They qualify. Here's my bid for it. You know, despite the fact that they could probably get a whole lot more if they rented that land, there were about the 43rd sign-up that just completed this spring. There were another 3.9 million acres that were put into CRP, were accepted for CRP across the nation, not just in Iowa, and for a total of about 30 million acres. So whenever you would draw 30 million acres, the hope is, from a commodity control standpoint, that you keep prices high by limiting the number of acres that's in production. But from a wildlife standpoint, when those acres come out, it can be devastating because they have no place to go. People say, well, they'll just go elsewhere. Yeah, well, they can go elsewhere to suboptimal habitat or no habitat at all. There were 700,000 acres came out in one fall out of CRP. That was absolutely devastating to wildlife populations. And so the gains that we make in the short run in those populations, and boy, they do respond when you put habitat back on the land, wildlife responds, that all those gains were undone. And I guess from a taxpayer's standpoint, I've heard lots of people say, I want to help farmers pay for conservation, but I want to do it once on a given piece of land. And what they see is paying for that conservation on that same piece of land over and over and over again. People will come out of programs and then go back into row crop production for a few years, and then it maybe goes back into some other conservation program later on. And some taxpayers are saying, wait a minute, is that the smartest way we can do this? Maybe we ought to pay for it once and not have to redo this a few years down the road.
Of course, putting an entire field into a conservation program is not the only way to develop habitat for wild creatures and put in good conservation practices.
Right.
And we have seen some very interesting changes, some interesting things being done in fields for soil conservation and for other reasons as well. Let's talk a little bit about some of the natural land that you see along waterways or some of the strips that you see integrated into fields.
Right. Part of the CRP program today has been the buffer strip program. It's probably one of the most valuable and permanent things that we can do on the land. And a lot of landowners have responded saying, yep, I want to put this buffer strip along the stream to keep the water where it should be, to keep water and soil on the land where it's still going to be productive of 30, 40, 100 years from now, and to keep the chemicals that I might apply, the fertilizers and pesticides, where they belong on the field, not in our waterways as well. So many, many people have responded to the buffer strip program. That is part of CRP as well, the Conservation Reserve Program. It's in the continuous sign-up program, and that has been very, very popular among many, many farmers and other landowners.
And how does that impact wildlife?
It impacts wildlife in some very positive ways because it provides, food, water, and cover is what are the three basics that all wildlife need, and it provides water, food, and cover close to one another so that it's the most efficient and effective way that they can reach all of their basic needs. So it's particularly for grassland species, it can be very positive. The downside of these narrow strips of land are, though, that they can be particularly subject to predation by things like raccoons and skunks and foxes and that sort of thing. And so sometimes those narrow strip habitats are not as good as when we for bird production in particular, as they were when, and I'm talking both songbirds and game birds and everything in between, as they were when we had much larger areas, whole fields, if you will, for it. But it's certainly better than nothing.
One of the things that has been concerning you in the last few years, and we've had, of course, record corn prices in the last few years, which makes it a very attractive time to grow as much corn as possible. What have you been seeing, though, in the last few years that has made you worried about the future?
Right. Yeah, it seems counterintuitive to me. If you look at signups for programs and for setting aside land for wildlife, we seem to do it when we can least afford to, which is quite interesting. It seems really counterintuitive to me, because when commodity prices were low, we had lots and lots of land in conservation reserve, wildlife wetland reserve program, and just landowners saying, no, I'm not going to farm that. And I think it was because it wasn't worth that much. But as land prices have risen, commodity prices have risen, and we now have record profits within the agricultural sector, the time at which we could actually afford more than ever to set aside land, we're seeing less and less in that. We're seeing more fence rows being torn out to get one more row in. We're seeing more and more grass waterways being torn up, which really bothers me because that's a time-proven soil conservation measure that also provides a little bit of a habitat. There's more and more land being turned into lots and lots of little groves of trees that stood for a long, for hundreds of years, being torn out so they could get a few more rows of corn in. Everything's being mowed in this sort of, I don't know what it is. Even ditches that were planted to prairie are now being mowed so that they look, quote unquote, neat somehow to folks going by. And lastly, I guess, so the attacks that we've seen by various politicians on public ownership of land that really is there for the benefit of the public, those attacks seem louder than ever before. So it's both practices on the land and what I hear coming out of the mouths of politicians sometimes that just really is dismaying and makes me wonder, as a public, what is it that we want for our landscape? And I think we need to have that conversation to begin it again, if you will, and say, wait a minute, we really want more than that for our land. And as a state, we need to demand that.
I'm talking with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Today we're talking about the land in Iowa and land stewardship. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Eric is on the line from Dallas Center. Hi, Eric.
Good morning.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I live out in the rural area between Dallas Center and Waukee, and I've noticed that there's some waterways that are through there that do have the buffer strips.
Mm-hmm.
However, it seems that the tile still come out the end of a culvert right over the water, and I don't know if those tiles should be terminated prior to the buffer strip to allow that water to go through there,
Yeah. That's a great question, and the answer is ideally yes. What we'd be doing with tile water, instead of dumping it directly into streams and rivers as we do now, what some people have done and very successfully, they're putting tile water into streamside or wetlands, oxbow wetlands or riverine wetlands on the side. And slowing down then the progress of that water from the drainage of the crop field, before it enters the waterway, it has time to then sit in this this wetland area. And what happens is that it tends to remove not only soil, but it removes the nutrients that come with that tile water, especially the nitrates. And it denitrifies. It takes the nitrogen out of the water, the fertilizer, if you will, and it stays in that wetland rather than ending up in the stream. And so ideally, that's what, of course, we'd love to see on the landscape, or a whole lot more wetlands that would process that tile water. Unfortunately, it's not always possible, depending on the lay of the landscape, and it does mean taking some land then that is in row crop production out of production and putting it into wetlands. As a society, then, we have to decide if that's something we want to pay for. Let's build that into the farm bills and other ways, maybe on a state basis, to help landowners afford to do that sort of thing.
Is there some place where I could find a diagram of how that is best accomplished in an existing set aside buffer strip?
That's a great question. I don't know of publications. There probably are some out there. I would check with two sources. One is your NRCS office, Natural Resource Conservation Service office. There's one in every county in the state. And you can also check with the Extension office and see if there is a recent publication. There are certainly buffer strip publications, and I'm trying to remember if there are tile water wetlands included in those. I don't believe, of the ones that I know of, I don't believe there are. But check with them and see if they've got with their publications on buffer strips.
Eric, thanks a lot for your call. And Jim, what do you think has changed? Why do you think that we are seeing politicians talking about selling off public land? Why do you think we're seeing these little groves of trees being ripped out? Why do you obviously we've got high corn prices, but
right.
What has changed that is making this seem like not an issue if you're farming?
You know, I'm not quite sure how to answer that, Charity. Because I know an awful lot of landowners, a lot of farmers who are terrific stewards of land. I think everybody who's listening knows. They say, "Well, that's not true of this landowner." It's probably not. I mean, they're really good, but I think we just need to think a bit more about the land. As you said in the promo for the program, the Leopold quote about treating land as a commodity rather than as something that we depend on. And I think we've gotten to that point because commodity prices are so high, because that you can make so much money off of the land, at least temporarily, we've tended to move away from that sort of ethical relationship with the land viewing it as a commodity. And Leopold, another quote he talked about was there's a whole section of his book in a Sand County Almanac called The Land Ethic. And while this was written in the 1940s, it applies, so much of it applies today as it did then. He said, if we had a land ethic, he said, and quote, in short, a land ethic changes the role of Homo sapiens, that's those humans, from conqueror of the land community to plain member and citizen of it. It implies respect for his fellow members and also respect for the community as such. And I think maybe we've forgotten that somehow. I think landowners know how important that is, but I think we in the surge to gain more money from the commodity, and I think a lot of farmers have been, if you remember 1985, boy, it was a tough time to be on the landscape, and so I think an awful lot of folks are saying, boy, I got to make hay now while the sun shines, because it may not be here down the road.
Land prices are, of course, extremely high right now as well. And we've talked about on this show many times how young farmers have a very difficult time.
Tough time.
Buying land, getting into the business.
Right.
Do you think the fact that so many farmers are renting land is part of this?
Yeah, probably. Again, when you rent land for, you know, $300 to $400 an acre, you want to get the maximum yield out of it you can. And so your input costs rise, but then you're getting more profits on the flip side. So, yeah, I think certainly rental more and more renting of land, fewer and fewer people on the landscape, and more landscape than ever to farm, means that an awful lot of people are farming, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5,000 acres, and a lot of that is rented land. So, I think that's probably part of it. It behooves all of us, though, people who are renting land as well as the people who own that land that they're renting to make sure that it's cared for properly. And again, it's not just soil conservation. That's critically important, no question about it. It's still our number one problem. But so is wildlife conservation and leaving aside those little wild places. You know, Leopold in another quote, he said, "I'm glad I shall never be young without wild places to be young in. Of what use are 40 freedoms without a blank spot on the map?" And those little wild places are those blank spots that we have to figure out how to keep.
I'm talking with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Today we're talking about our relationship with land in Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. And today we're talking about our relationship with the land in Iowa and land ethics, land stewardship, the importance of taking care of this land that, of course, will remain and impact generations forever.
Right.
You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Jim, we have seen some things, and we've talked about this on the show. We've seen some things in the past few years that, for people who are interested in conservation, seem incredibly encouraging. I mean, one of those things, of course, is the resurgence of bald eagles all around
right.
the state of Iowa. And recently, in just the last few weeks, people have been spotting a black bear in Bremer County.
Right. Yeah, it's quite interesting. The news reports, when I first heard the bear stories that were coming out, I heard a school in northeast Iowa, locked down their doors so that nobody would go out. I mean, this is a bear, for gosh sakes. This isn't something that's going to eat your children.
It's a black bear, too.
Yeah, it's a black bear, too, yeah. And yet our experience with wildlife is often one of this this sort of adversarial relationship, you know, where we fear them or that we feel they are hurting our yard or our property in some way, and so we have this sort of adversarial relationship, and so we need to get beyond that. Certainly, there are bears spotted in Iowa almost every year for many, many years now. And the reason is that male bears in particular are extremely territorial. Bears are common in Minnesota and parts of much of Wisconsin as well. And because the males are very territorial, the larger and older the bear, the bigger their territory. And so it leaves not much room for young male bears to find new territory. So often they get shunted out into the hinterlands in search of vacant territory, as you were. And frequently those male bears, young male bears, wander into Iowa in search of bearable territory, if you will. Pardon the pun. Sorry. they come into Iowa. And if people are not used to being around bears, as most Iowans are not, unless they've lived in Minnesota or Wisconsin or Alaska, it becomes this strange sort of reaction. Oh, let's lock down the school. And it's just kind of silly, it seems to me. But the bear is simply trying to make a living and doing it in an area where there aren't other bears to compete with. There really are. It doesn't say so much about our landscape as it does about the bear population farther north.
There is this interesting sort of push and pull, though, as people, if they are, you know, if they believe in conservation, if they want to create more habitat,
right.
and then there seems to be this fear when we see a cougar in Iowa, for example.
Yeah.
When we see a bear in Iowa, we have brought back some habitat that can support native species in the state, but we want to be very selective about those native species.
That's right, yeah. You can't always get what you want. But didn't the Rolling Stones write a song about that?
Something along those lines.
I'm excited to see bears in Iowa. I mean, I'm a beekeeper, and so I wouldn't be excited to have the bear destroy my beehives, but on the other hand, that's kind of the cost of doing business, I figure. And so it's like, I'd love to have them around. But we have such a manicured landscape, manicured not only in terms of row crops, but manicured the way we keep our yards. And even now, increasingly, it seems more and more of our roadsides, that in fact, boy, anything that disturbs that manicuring seems to be disturbing to our psyches as well. So, yeah.
Well, let's talk. We'll talk in a moment more about things that individuals can do, even if they don't own very much land. Tom wants to get involved in the conversation, though, and from Cedar Falls. Hi, Tom.
Yeah.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I would like to tell Jim that I'm outside right now working. And I hear him loud and clear. I'm a landowner in southern Blackhawk County, and I've converted over about 11 acres of what was crop ground that's part of our home lot into native Iowa trees.
Fantastic.
And I've talked with the state forester in our area about this, and I started in 2007. And the amount of wildlife that I've seen just in the last couple years has really been impressive, that's returning back to this habitat. But my question for Jim and for anybody that might want to call in is, you know, how can I keep this habitat in its current state, or, you know, in a protected state with development all around? I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call, Tom.
Yep,
great
bye.
Question, and congratulations, Tom, creating some more habitat out of what was row crop. So I appreciate your doing that. There are lots of ways to protect that land. You can do it in perpetuity, in fact, by putting what's called a conservation easement on your land. What that does, a landowner has a certain bundle of rights. I think we should also have a bundle of obligations as well as rights. But when they purchase the land, if you think of it as sort of a bundle of sticks in your hand, when you sell off an easement, or you give an easement, you can either sell it or give it, you essentially take some of those sticks and give them to somebody else so that it's a smaller bundle of rights than on that land. And a conservation easement essentially says this will be in this state or some wild state in perpetuity for this on this piece of land. That obligates then not only your heirs, but any future purchaser of that land to keep that land in a wild state. Now, a caution is that land won't stay the same. Nature constantly changes. The trees will grow larger. You may have invasive species come in. You may have a fire go through. You know, things happen. But in fact, that it won't be subject to development if someone holds that conservation easement for you. Those conservation easements are often held by nonprofit groups such as the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. They are sometimes held by public groups like County Conservation Board or their friends groups, offshoots of that. So there are the Nature Conservancy is another one that holds lots of conservation easements. So you essentially are giving a portion of those rights, in this case the development rights, to that group to hold to ensure that land stays wild. So that's a good way to approach it.
I can imagine farmers listening to this kind of conversation and feeling threatened.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, there are trade-offs that have to be made when you talk about conservation. For the farmers who are listening right now, mm-hmm. what's in it for them? Why should they think about bigger buffer strips? Why should they think about putting more land in a CRP or even just trying to set aside the land on their own?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And I don't mean for this to be threatening to all, but I do mean it to kind of tweak our consciences, if you will, because we're all in this community together. Yes, you may own a piece of land. You may have certain rights that come with it. But as I said, it's not just about what our rights are as landowners, but I think it's about what our responsibilities for stewardship are as well. So I think we have to have this sort of ethical conversation that it's got to happen in all aspects of our life. It's got to happen around the dinner table. It's got to happen in our schools, in our churches, in public meetings. We just had this conversation last night. I happen to be chair of the Story County Conservation Board, and we had a public conversation. We had 60-some people show up at our meeting last night. We usually have 1 to 3, you know, and it was all over what the public perceived and the board perceived as a threat to one of our premier parks here in Story County by the placement of a hog lot, a potential placement of a hog lot near that land. And the public got involved and said, wait a minute, we have an obligation as a public to be involved in this land because this is our land. You own the land nearby, but that implies something more. That implies a community that supports one another, that helps one another out. And we kept hearing that sort of over and over last night. It was quite interesting to me to watch the community become involved in what is, in fact, a community issue. How do we become members of that community? And how do we include others who might think differently and others that might live differently, including wildlife? How do we include them in this community? And we were getting at some of that last night. It was quite fascinating to watch. So I think we need to have these conversations, and there have to be farmers and city people and suburban folks and people who love wildlife and people who hunt wildlife and people who don't hunt wildlife and, you know, on and on. I think we need everybody involved in this conversation because this landscape is so important to Iowans, and we need to continue to decide what about our ethical relationship, about what happens is going to happen in this land. Because if we don't, I really fear that we're going to have a future in this state that is more industrial, that is without the critters that I think we are linked to very intimately.
This proposal in Story County would be for a large capacity, over 2,400 hogs in this confinement. It would be built or would have been built or may be built about a mile from Hickory Grove Lake Park, near Colo. Mm-hmm. What are your concerns? Why do you think that this kind of industrial agriculture can't coexist that near a wild place?
Because that park in particular is an extremely popular park for people. It's already an impaired watershed, and we've been working for the last several years working with landowners in the watershed to try and make all the soil conservation, all the nutrient conservation, all the wildlife conservation we can in that watershed to improve the quality of the water in that lake, and it's what we found, of course, is that people are concerned not only about the water, but about the air quality and the odors as well. So it's the same concerns that every time a large confinement facility, be it hogs or cattle or anything, is proposed to be built in an area. It's the same concerns, I think, that have been expressed over and over. In this particular case, they've been careful to keep it under a certain number of hogs so that it cannot it doesn't come under local rule. The legislature has tied the hands of boards of supervisors and the DNR in many cases to not allow further review. So it's a very difficult situation, and one that the public is very frustrated. Boards of supervisors are often very frustrated, and those of us who are in charge of public parks are very frustrated as well.
Jim, most of us don't own large amounts of land in rural Iowa, clearly.
Right,
For people who care about conservation, who are concerned about conservation, but can't do anything on their own acreage, what can we do?
Yeah, well, I think there are lots of things you can do in your own yard, and we've got have lots of programs about that on here. There are lots of publications available. How can you plant your own yard to make room for wildlife in there? There are often lots of community projects as well that you can become involved in. Talk to your county conservation boards in your own counties. Lots of projects there. Talk to other conservation groups, everything from Pheasants Forever and Ducks Unlimited, the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. All of them have projects in all over the state that volunteers can become involved in and say, okay, I'm going to make this a better place for wildlife. I think there's also an obligation to talk to our public officials, those that represent us in the legislature and in Congress, so that we make that new farm bill have strong conservation provisions, but also have conservation compliance. I was glad to see Senator Harkin just mention that yesterday. In fact, he said, you know, I love the conservation provisions, but I want to see it with conservation compliance. And I think lots of people would as well. In Iowa, in 2010, in a very otherwise conservative election, Iowans, 63%, passed the I Will Amendment to the Iowa's Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment to the Constitution. But the legislature has yet to fund it. Iowans said, we want funding for conservation, and it could fund much of the kinds of things that we've been talking about this morning, could help fund a state share of that. We would have some way of in perpetuity of keeping wild places here for wildlife and for folks to enjoy. But we have to find funding for it, and the legislature has got to step up and do that. So I think as citizens, getting involved on the community level and not being afraid to talk to public officials, as well as having this conversation around the dinner table, talking to your own family, to your friends about these kinds of issues, I think is a really important first step.
Jim, thank you.
My pleasure.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease lives in Ames, Iowa. He'll be back again next month. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Technical support today from Jason Burns in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can get in touch with us anytime. Our email address, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'd love to hear your response to things you've heard on the show. We'd love to hear your suggestions about things you'd like to hear on the show. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.